welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are pleased that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, Fargo Theater Executive Director Emily Beck sat down with Prairie Public CEO John Harris to discuss the landmark 100-year legacy of the Fargo Theater. We'll have an excerpt from that Prairie Pulse interview, and also Chef Candace Stock joins Prairie Plates to explore spring foraging and discuss indigenous foods that will be available at the soon-to-be-opened Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and you probably heard the story of a cruise ship stuck at sea because a deadly virus sickened some of its passengers. On this week's Prairie Beat, our regional news podcast, a reminder about the virus's history in North Dakota and to be careful when cleaning your lake cabin.
Hey there, I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thanks for joining us again this week for Prairie Beat,
our weekly news podcast from those of us here at Prairie Public. Where else, Danielle, what is going on in the news this week?
So earlier this week, I did a story about hantavirus because once in a while, hantavirus hits the news cycle. And it's something that we do like to talk about here in North Dakota from time to time.
Yeah, well, and Gene Hackman and his wife who passed away from hantavirus,
yeah.
That was the last time it was a big major national /international headline, and now we have this cruise ship to nowhere, at least. We don't know where it's going out in the middle of the Atlantic near the Cape Verde Islands right now. It's getting a ton of attention.
So, yeah, you're not wrong about that. I admit to doom scrolling a lot, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, other stuff going on in the world.
Yeah.
So because of that, I'm seeing a range of discussions about this cruise ship with the hantavirus on it. I mean, anywhere from, you know, this is not something that the greater public needs to be panicking about, mm-hmm. all the way to, oh, my God, this is the start of a global catastrophe. Everyone freak out. But, you know, it's certainly capturing the attention of many people.
Well,
sure.
We've been conditioned for that. My goodness, the COVID pandemic. We could blame somebody for a catastrophizing this moment, but yeah, we're probably all a little skittish about any suggestion that there could be another global pandemic anytime soon. So what can you tell us about what's happening with this cruise ship, Daniel?
Yeah, so I did a little reading from some different sources this morning on it. You know, my in-laws, they are prolific cruisers, right? And they've taken one or two every year for a long time. They've taken my husband and I and his siblings and their spouses on a couple of cruises too. So I've been on those boats. I think when most people think of cruising, you know, they think of you get on a boat for a week or two and, you know, you see a few stops in a tropical location, right? Or maybe you go up to Alaska, that sort of thing. So this cruise, I would say it's geared toward much more of those hardcore cruisers. This boat is the MV Hondius. It took off from the southern tip of South America from Argentina on April 1st. And it's embarking on a pretty substantial trip. These cruises go for a month or longer. And about a week after the ship left, a 70-year-old man on the ship fell ill. And a few days later, on April 11th, he passed away. His body was removed from the ship on April 24th. The man's 69-year-old wife got off the boat at the same time at St. Helena, which is off the coast of southern Africa. And she ended up passing away, too, just a couple of days later. Her test results came back on May 4th for hantavirus. And while that was all going on, a second passenger fell ill on the ship, evacuated to South Africa on May 2nd, that passenger tested positive for hantavirus as well. So that same day, a third passenger that had gotten sick on April 28th passed away on the ship. And on May 3rd, that's when the World Health Organization began reporting that they suspected a hantavirus outbreak may be on this ship.
Oh, gosh, that is just terrifying. Yeah. Now, hantavirus is from rodents, right? I mean, we're chatting about it in the office the other day, and we figure it was probably an infestation on the boat. At least that's what we first thought. People were, you know, breathing in those aerosolized particles from the rodent droppings and urine. I mean, that's what we know about hantavirus and how it works. It's gross and all that, but that's where, you know, hantavirus comes from. So what's going on with all that? Do they know yet if that's how the outbreak began?
I read an article from the Associated Press this morning that said the World Health Organization is still trying to figure out where it began. So something about hantavirus is that, yes, as you just said, you know, it's a virus spread by rodents through their droppings. It can also be spread, you know, in rare cases through their saliva if they happen to bite you. But it is actually very rare. It doesn't spread from person to person. But the caveat to that here is that this cruise ship that took off from, you know, Argentina, in this specific part of the world, there is a specific strain from there. It's called the Andes strain. Mm. And that strain can spread person to person. It's the only one that does this. And it has a history of doing that before any of this happened. So what they're doing right now is they're contact tracing. A lot of cruise ships carry a lot of passengers, but this one only has about 150 people on board. And they're really wanting to get all that figured out because hantavirus can have a pretty long incubation period, up to 6 weeks or so, maybe even a little longer. And it can be very deadly. It has a 40 to 60% mortality rate.
Okay, underscore that. That is the scariest part of them all, Danielle. And, you know, that part of Argentina, I believe, is Patagonia. So there are a lot of, you know, nature explorers, bird watchers that flock to that part of the world. And so I imagine there could be some contact tracing with more people that may be taking other forms of transportation to get out of there. So who knows? It certainly does make one just a tad bit skittish, I would say. But man, that high mortality rate. If you catch the disease, it really does not look good as far as treatment. It's just basically palliative at that point.
Yes. The person-to-person spread, you know, as we talked about with this strain, it is there. But the one other thing about it, too, is like it's not an airborne virus like COVID or like measles, like we've talked about. Measles is extremely contagious and it's airborne. If someone walks through a room and breathes, you know, in there for a few minutes and they shed a ton of virus, that could get other people sick. But this hantavirus is not the same.
Whew, okay, that does make me feel a little bit better. But it's got to be stressful for those folks on the boat. I mean, you know, cruise ships, as we know, they're a magnet for spreading diseases. You think of the Norwalk virus as just being in close contact with people, you know, utensils are being touched, and it kind of makes sense.
Yes, and what it looks like they're going to have to do is have these passengers monitor for symptoms. People who get seriously ill are being evacuated off the boat and quarantined and treated as they're able to treat them. You know, if I were in charge of all of this, you know, from what I understand about this virus and how it works, is I would get these passengers off the boat, away from each other. They'd have to have a safe place to isolate, you know, for several weeks while they monitor for those symptoms. But, you know, yeah, this is an ongoing developing situation and it's evolving as we speak. So we'll see, you know, how it pans out, how they handle it.
And like we did during COVID, when a lot of us would isolate ourselves away from our family, if we would get it at a hotel, you know, just quarantine, hold up in a hotel, get some DoorDash and life is good, you know. Okay, so staying on the subject of hantavirus and referring to that story you did earlier this week, it can happen in North Dakota, and it has. Mm-hmm. North Dakota is a rural state, and that's typically that's where you see hantavirus occasionally make its way into the headlines again. We've had that here in North Dakota. We have rodents around, especially those deer mice most commonly associated with the disease.
Yes, so North Dakota began surveilling for hantavirus in 1993, and I actually remember when that began because, you know, I'm a farm kid. It was something my mother specifically was really worried about. She didn't want us kids, you know, getting into any of the older outbuildings and stirring up any of those materials and possibly getting sick because it is very deadly. But since 1993, it's very rare. We've only had 20 cases of hantavirus in the state. And getting back to how serious of that virus it is, you know, 9 of those 20 people who tested positive here in North Dakota did end up tragically passing away from it. I talked to Michelle Detloff at Health and Human Services. She's director of epidemiology and infectious diseases. And she says the illness starts off like many others do.
Fever, muscle aches, body aches, fatigue. Those are the early symptoms. And usually it can range anywhere from 1 to 8 weeks, but usually it's about 2 weeks after someone's exposed that they start having those signs and symptoms. And then usually about 7 days later on average, the serious signs start to develop, such as a pulmonary syndrome, such as things with the lungs, cough, rapid shallow breathing, shortness of breath.
So yeah, it's a pretty serious disease, and thankfully, like we've been talking about, it's pretty rare, but unfortunately, there are not any treatments or vaccines for it either. So if someone does get sick, the only thing they can really do for them is supportive care. This is the time of year when folks are typically opening up their lake cabins, getting into their sheds, breaking out the yard equipment.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, that's a very common ritual that we do around these parts. Since mice like to get into those quiet, undisturbed places over the winter, that's especially a reason to look out for that if you have a lake cabin. So are there some specific cleaning instructions for that?
Yes. So they want you to open windows and doors, let the space air out and ventilate pretty good for at least a half hour or so. And if you do see any signs of rodents like droppings or nesting materials, you'll want to clean the area pretty carefully. Michelle Detloff says any commercial disinfectant works great.
Make sure it's registered with the Environmental Protection Agency or EPA, and then just follow those directions on there. They're going to say things like, if you're making a bleach solution, how much bleach to water, brave the droppings, the mouse nest, let it set for about 5 minutes, and then you can work in a glove. Carefully pick that up, put it in a plastic bag, and throw it in the trash.
Yeah, gloves. And probably a mask wouldn't be a bad idea, too, if we're talking about those aerosolized particles, right?
Yeah, it certainly couldn't hurt.
So, thank you, Danielle, for all that.
You bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news, or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
That's it for this week. Anniversary alert. Hey, this is episode number 50 of Prairie Beat. Can you believe that, Danielle? Yeah. Nice job on this.
Thank you. I can believe it, actually.
Well, I'm Eric Dethridge. It's a pleasure being your little co-host here, Danielle.
Thank you very much. And yes, I am Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat again next week.
We're 50 episodes in with Prairie Beat. Congratulations to Danielle and Eric. Thank you for listening to it. If you haven't subscribed to Prairie Beat, you can do so wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel Bismarck, offering a Mother's Day brunch buffet in the Terrace Restaurant, Sunday, May 10th from 9:30 to 1. Featuring omelets made to order, Caesar-crusted chicken, an assortment of desserts, and more. More information online at the Radisson of Bismarck Facebook page.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we now share an excerpt from Prairie Pulse. It's Prairie Public's weekly television public affairs program that features long-form conversations with regional leaders, artists, authors, and newsmakers. In this excerpt, Prairie Public CEO John Harris visited with Fargo Theater Executive Director Emily Beck about the theater's centennial celebration, its legacy in downtown Fargo, and the role this iconic venue continues to play in the region's arts and culture scene. Prairie Pulse airs Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Central on the television service of Prairie Public.
Hello, and welcome to Prairie Pulse. Joining us now is the Executive Director of the Fargo Theater, Emily Beck. Emily, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. I was born right here in Fargo, North Dakota. Spent the first few years of my childhood here, and then I grew up in Valley City. I came back to the Fargo-Moorhead area to attend school at MSUM, where I studied film history and criticism, and that's really when I started falling in love with the Fargo Theater. And after my graduation, I worked for a few years for the Marcus Theaters Corporation, and then in 2008, I joined the Fargo Theater team.
Okay, mm-hmm. 2008. For those who don't know, because we got viewers from all across and listeners for that matter, tell us about the Fargo Theater.
My favorite subject. The Fargo Theater just has my whole heart. It is a very unique place and an absolute treasure in our community. It's a historic landmark. Just celebrated its centennial this year. It's an icon for the city. Our marquee has been named the most photographed location in Fargo. But we're so much more than just the historic building, than just being a landmark. Inside of the Fargo Theater is an arts organization that offers programming about 300 days and nights a year. We show new release movies, specialty movies, and we have lots of live events on our stage as well.
Yeah. Well, this year marks the centennial anniversary. Congratulations. How does it feel to celebrate 100 years of this landmark?
Oh, it's been incredible. The outpouring of love that we've seen from the community has been nothing short of remarkable. And you only get to, an organization like us only gets to 100 years because we are part of a community that is so dedicated to the arts, to our culture, to our history, and that they see the Fargo Theater as an important part of that, important part of our identity. So it has been a whirlwind of a year as we plan for the centennial, but it has been, sorry, I'm a bit emotional. It's been one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. We're hearing stories from people that have made memories for generations in their families at the Fargo Theater, and it's hard not to be touched by that.
Yeah. So what's the official anniversary date? What was it?
It was March 15th of 2026.
I know I always hate naming names, but who are some of the people who've made it possible for the Fargo Theater to have existed for 100 years?
Oh my goodness, there's too many to mention. This really is a community labor of love. One of the people that we celebrated on March 15th, though, is somebody I would love to shout out. Rick Solarski received our Fargo Theater Luminary Award because, believe it or not, there was a time when a corporation wanted to buy the Fargo Theater and tear down and turn it into a parking lot. And Rick was amongst a group of folks with the Red River Theater Organ Society that said, this is special, this is worth preserving and protecting. And Rick really took the lead on that. So he is one of so many people that's responsible for the theater still being here and still thriving.
Of course, you've been talking about it, but you know, put into words, how important would you say the Fargo Theater is to the community?
Well, obviously, I'm a little biased. but I think we've seen firsthand, especially with the centennial, how much it means to people. And it means different things to different people. Whether it's a place that they went with their family every December to watch the Blenders and they have those warm holiday memories with us, or we're a sign that says home to them. It's been pretty remarkable to see that outpouring.
Well, the historic landmark is part of it, and that's part of the rich history. But you also added Theater B, the small theater. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. In 2009, the theater expanded to a duplex. So that means we're a movie theater with two screens. Theater 2 is a part of an urban infill project led by the Kilbourn Group. So it's part of the same building. If you've seen Sandy's Donuts or Herbert and Gerbert's on Broadway, our Theater 2 is actually part of that same building. And that addition has been tremendous for our organization. It's allowed us to expand our programming in some really exciting ways.
Recently, you held the 26th annual Fargo Film Festival. Did the theater do anything to recognize the centennial during the festival?
Absolutely. One of the highlights of this year's festival was the worldwide premiere of the film Preschool, which was directed by Josh Duhamel and starred Josh Duhamel. And I think the theater centennial was a big part of the reason that was able to happen, and that Josh was able to come and spend time with us. And so we definitely saw that premiere as a special celebration within the festival that was also somewhat tied to our centennial.
Well, an organization like the theater, Fargo Theater, you don't reach 100 years without some obstacles along the way. You mentioned the one about tearing it down for a parking lot, but what are some of the challenges that, well, the theater, and for that matter, any nonprofit arts organization faces?
Sure. Well, they're numerous. The pandemic was certainly a challenge for the Fargo Theater, but yet again, our community stepped up and supported us through our closure when there were no movies being released and no acts on tour. So we were very fortunate to be a nonprofit, to have that support from our community with donations, with curbside popcorn sales. Everybody just came out and they supported us. And that was... Now, as I look back, there was a lot of love in those days that were very uncertain.
You know, something the theater has, the pipe organ, and you mentioned the Organ Society. Can you tell us about that relationship?
Oh, they have been our partners from day one. The Red River Theater Organ Society is a group of incredible people who are very dedicated to the preservation and continuation of the art form that is playing a theater pipe organ, which is, it's a bit different than, say, a pipe organ you might find at a church. And these folks are so dedicated to keeping it in good shape, keeping it in repair, keeping it tuned, and keeping a nice roster of players, of developing new talent, because it takes years and years and years to learn how to play that incredible instrument. So we're very fortunate that we have such an active chapter of the Organ Society here in the Red River Valley, and they have been the Fargo Theater's partners from day one.
Well, Emily, I understand the theater is currently running a capital campaign for renovations. Mm-hmm. So tell us more about that.
Sure. Kind of in celebration of our centennial, we launched a $5.5 million capital campaign to restore the Fargo Theater's beautiful Art Deco interior, and fund some really important projects that might not be quite as glamorous, but are incredibly necessary to the continuation of our services. So there's a large-scale plumbing project, HVAC project, some electrical work that needs to be done, and that beautiful Fargo Theater marquee, which actually houses nearly 900 light bulbs. Each and every one of those 900 light bulbs has to be changed. They're still incandescent bulbs, and they need to be upgraded to LED. So that's just one of the projects that we have going.
When do you expect the renovations to be complete this time?
What's
the target date?
Yeah. Oh, we're taking it all in phases. Our next phase is plumbing and projectors. We have to replace miles of water pipes and replace our digital movie projectors. And we're hoping to have that done by October of this year. After that, it'll just be in stages as we complete the fundraising.
Well, as you said, being a Fargo native, and you've already expressed some of this, what does it mean to you to be a part of the Fargo Theater's history?
Again, I'm sorry, I get a little choked up when I talk about this, because when you're looking at an organization that's been a part of our city's story for 100 years, my little 17 years at the Fargo Theater, it just feels like the tiniest slice, but it is an honor to be a shepherd, even for my relatively short period of time, to something that has meant so much to so many people.
What can the Fargo Theater patrons and community look forward to for the next 100 years?
Well, I'm not sure about the next 100 years, although I truly believe that the theater will make it to that next milestone. But for the year ahead, we want the party to continue. We want the celebration to continue. We are so full of gratitude. We want to share that with the community and continue to gather people together to celebrate. So in April, we are launching our Centennial Film Series that will feature one title each month from each of the theater's decades of existence. So one from the 20s, one from the 30s, and so forth. So in April, it was Fargo. The movie Fargo was celebrating its 30th anniversary, and we thought that couldn't just be a coincidence. So we kicked things off with the film Fargo. And then you could see a different film from a different decade each month moving forward.
Well, with that, what else can people look forward to for the rest of the centennial year, into fall and winter maybe?
Mm-hmm. So that Centennial Film Series will continue. We have Buster Keaton's silent film, The General, just a masterpiece coming up. And then we'll go into One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest the following month. And something that'll be available all year long will be our very special Fargo Theater Centennial merchandise, which is available online and at the Fargo Theater box office. It was just another way we could get everybody in on the celebration.
Well, if people want to find out more information, if they want to contribute to the theater, or if they want to come see a movie, where's the best place to find information?
FargoTheater.org, everything. Upcoming movies, events, information on our campaign, everything right there.
Well, Emily, we wish you the best. You've been doing a great job, and thank you.
And that was an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show with Prairie Public CEO John Harris and the Fargo Theater's executive director, Emily Beck. To hear the entire interview, search for Prairie Pulse and Prairie Public to hear it on our website at prairiepublic.org. Still ahead on today's Main Street, Chef Candace Stock joins Prairie Plates to explore spring foraging and indigenous foods at the soon-to-be-open Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Welcome to another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Guion. This week we're going to talk a little bit about spring foraging, and we're going to talk about how to cook with some of those items or what to cook with some of those items. But first we're going to talk a little bit about some of the ventures of our friend, Chef Candace Stock. Chef Candace, welcome back to the Prairie Public Studios, or Foodios.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, Candace, you've been up to a lot lately, doing some TV with Prairie Public. Thanks for that. And also a cooking class with some children out in Detroit Lakes that looked like a lot of fun. What did you make?
So we had brunch. I had the groups, age groups, kind of split up by how difficult some of the recipes were. And one group did nettle pancakes, nettle wild rice pancakes. Another did a component to go with the pancakes. It was a squash and apple compote. And then we had bison kebabs that were probably the star of the show. The kids absolutely loved them. And then just like a light salad with lots of vegetables and an elderberry vinaigrette. And I think like having all these kids having real hands-on experience and enjoying the food made it a lot more approachable for them also, because they wanted to try everything that everybody made. And I required all the kids to talk about what they made, what the difficulties were, what they enjoyed. And I think the experience, you know, will stick, hopefully, and that they'll want to cook more at home.
And we'll talk about nettles in a little bit, but I think getting kids started on healthy cooking with natural ingredients is really important.
Yeah. No, I think once they have it, once they experience it and realize that it's not overwhelming or anything like that in subtle preparations, they're more likely to try it again. And also, they'll recognize it. I mean, they retain so much. And so you say nettle, they'll say, I've had that, you know, and kind of keep going with it. They also had staghorn sumac, and I had them muddling their spices and putting it in the food. And so they got to see kind of whole forms of things and then breaking it down and putting it into their recipes.
Staghorn sumac, a very healthy ingredient. Another thing I'd like to talk about here is some more of what you've been up to with the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Medora. Everyone is excited for the opening soon, and I'm guessing you're doing some food out there.
Yep, the restaurant is getting ready to move into our kitchen space, and foraging is also a great teaching point for our staff, but also all of our participants that come to the library, and that we're going to be incorporating a lot of the indigenous plants into our menu. We're going to have a medicinal garden as well, but our native plant project is bringing back a lot of plants that had kind of been choked out by invasive species. And so we get to tend those plants and use them as medicine in our food. So I'm really excited, and I think that every time I go out there, I find more things. The growing season for a lot of plants out there is like you've got this little window, but when it hits, there's so much abundance, and because of this native plant project, I swear every time I go out to Medora, it is more green, and everything is just flourishing, and I can attest to like my windshield getting covered in bugs, but like the pollinators, the bees have just been like in full flow, and they're already out.
That's really good to see. And well, honey production is a big thing in North Dakota too. And that's really fun to see natural honey and that production. But it sounds like you like the job. It sounds like a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. And I think that I am surrounded by a lot of incredibly talented, passionate people, and we all just kind of like vibe off of each other, and everyone wants to learn what everyone else is doing. And so already like our staff has a raw milk group and getting their local eggs and interested in foraging and sourcing more local ingredients just for their own home use. And that's exactly what I would like to see for all communities, is being able to have access to those types of things.
My family's from southwestern North Dakota, and I have some friends that are interested in foraging out in that area. Are there some plants they should be watching out for in the springtime out there?
Springtime, so the spruce tips, cedar bough, I use a lot of that within my cooking. The yarrow is already starting to come through, which is a great plant to use medicinally, especially for women. And then there's just like a lot of beautiful budding flowers right now. And with those, you can use them medicinally, you can use those topically. I think that you're not going to see a lot of wild asparagus or mushrooms or anything like that. I think what kind of like the food medicine actually looks like is just that like first growth and these flowers. So there's tons of yucca plants out in the Badlands, and you can eat the flowers, you can use the root system. But the flowers are beautiful in flavor. And right now I feel like the juniper also is probably the most pungent of the season. Like, I don't know what it is, but I take a little berry when I go out foraging and I just chew on them, and it just like opens up all of the sinuses. You can feel your blood kind of warm. And I think like that's exactly what you need on a day like this when it's like back in the 40s. But like it is everything that's growing out there is just like incredibly potent because that soil is so alkaline and salty and...
Well, anything you're planning on the menu for the library that you can disclose, or anything you've been cooking lately that you've really enjoyed to make?
So for the menu at the library, there are a lot of great products that we're getting locally. Even from this side of the state, we have our flours and grains and beans. But really, I think like... The thing that I tell people that I am the most excited about is just having creative freedom for some of my staff. I've established a menu, and it's very approachable. I have a smoked bison brisket that we're turning into bacon, and then we're going to make BLTs on a wild rice cranberry sourdough, which I think will go over really well. But at the same time, like, I know what my food tastes like, and like I feel like I'm more excited about running specials with my staff and seeing what they come up with. A lot of them are from that area and aren't used to cooking with foraged ingredients. And so it's going to be their first time. They're going to test out new things. And I think that, like, being open to their creative thinking will really generate some exciting options.
And how's the preparation going for the opening of the library?
Well, we're not moved into the building yet. So I think, like, everything is just on paper. And that's a little bit intimidating in that I don't know exactly what it's going to look like when we move in. We've theorized and troubleshoot problems that could arise. But for right now, it's still all in theory. And so we'll see. I think that with the staff that I have, though, I'm sure that we're going to be capable of pulling all of this off and having a really great year.
I'm sure it'll be a special place. We're talking with Chef Candace Stock today about foraging, her role at the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. And I think we're going to get into foraging a little bit more, maybe locally here in the eastern side of the state, western Minnesota, because as you mentioned, there are differences, soil, mm-hmm. you know, temperature, that sort of thing, terroir. And so I think in the east you can, or western Minnesota, you can find things like ramps and nettles. And we mentioned nettles earlier, but I like to go down by the river and just the Red River here and just check things out, the Buffalo River, Otter Tail River, and just check things out. In Fargo here, you can't find a lot of ramps, at least I don't, but you do find nettles. You see the burdock coming up. Mm-hmm. A few other things. Talk about what you can find in the Red River just down by the river.
Yeah, no, I think nettles are always kind of like a staple in my food because they're so abundant. But the garlic mustard is coming up right now, too.
Ah, I'll have to look for that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's that's one of those ingredients that like goes a long way a little bit because it has that spice of mustard and garlic flavor. Once it gets to the point where it is forming little flowers, buds, you can cut that off and cook it like broccoli. Mm. It is still going to be like the same flavor, more intense, but a little bit more substantial and great in texture. But that is one of those plants that's also invasive, so go and get it. Just take all of it, you know? It's going to be really good for you, but it does kind of change the composition of the soil a bit, and so it makes it less inhabitable for indigenous species. Hosta shoots, milkweed shoots are also edible. We'll cook up kind of like wild asparagus, There's, I would say, if you go even just like a bit further north of Moorhead, you can find it growing in the ditches. And don't cause like any traffic accidents, like don't stop on the road. But like if you just watch, you can see them coming up. I think it takes practice, but we do have a lot of variety just right here on the border. And so... yeah.
There is a lot of excitement when you find something fun, and you do get a fever, at least I do, when I'm out looking for mushrooms. And I think the big question right now for foragers is, when do you think people will start seeing morel mushrooms? I mean, you do see them in western Minnesota, mm-hmm. but you do see them in the Missouri River bottoms. I picked them in the Bismarck Mandan area.
Yeah, no, I think that also with how much snowfall we've had this year and just kind of like the fluctuation of temperatures have actually been really great for mycelium growth. And so this year should be great for mushrooms. I mean, I've gone out and I've seen a lot more activity. I mean, like you can see like the white veins on the side of logs and stuff like that. And that's always a good indicator that there's going to be mushroom growth. But yeah, I think that this year we'll be able to find a good amount. I think that morels... I haven't seen any. I've gone down kind of like more south in Minnesota and have seen just an abundance of ramps and growth. And I think that we're maybe like a couple weeks behind kind of like that temperature zone. And so it shouldn't be long and we'll be able to see more close to home.
And with ramps, a lot of people say don't dig them up. You know, if you have a big patch, maybe a few of them would be okay, but just cutting the leaves off is probably the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I always just break them off.
Yeah.
If I pull it and it comes up with the bulb, then I don't put it back, but,
right.
I don't aim to take the full bulb. More and more people are pulling up the bulbs. But also I think like, with like all the efforts in the community to remove buckthorn and other invasive species, like it has made a difference in how much comes back the next year. Areas where I've seen these initiatives take place, like I am seeing a lot more ramps come up. I am seeing a lot more mushrooms come back. And so it's beautiful. And all of these plants and really require our interaction in order to thrive.
I think some respect too mm-hmm. for the environment you're in is a big thing. With
foraging. For sure. Yeah.
If you had morels and ramps, is there a special dish you would make?
Oh man.
Tough question. So many
you know,
possibilities.
I think like I don't eat a lot of pasta. But one of the staples growing up in my household was always wild rice hot dish. And so doing kind of like a creamier wild rice, almost risotto, I think would be really beautiful this year. Otherwise, like I do a lot of like purees and I'll dehydrate my ramps and use them in different applications, seasoning, stuff like that. Like just pan fried morels with butter and like little bit of ramp in there. I think that the most simple for me is probably the best, where you really get to taste those ingredients. And the only way I would pair them is with other indigenous ingredients, things that, yeah, come from the same soil, come from the same area. I think they do the best to complement each other.
We talked about spruce tips earlier, and those are kind of fun to pick.
Yeah. I foraged quite a bit last year, and a lot of the people that I served them to had never had them before. So it was a great experience, and now they're looking forward to it. And so getting ready for those to come into fruition so that I can put them on my menu out at the library.
Are there any recommendations you have for listeners to learn more about foraging? We're not mycologists or botanists here, but there are a lot of resources out there. We're looking at a book right now called The Forager Chef's Book of Flora by Alan Burgo. And then I brought in a Field Guide to Mushrooms, a National Audubon Society book. And I find these books are very helpful, but anything maybe online or any resources used over the years or classes?
Yeah, no, I would say that these books are incredible resources. I've invested a lot in different foraging books, but also Native American ethnobotany books. Mm-hmm. Because people say, oh, you can't eat that, or it's not edible. Sometimes that's not even true. It wasn't edible for people here, but further south, they would use it for tinctures. They would use it in tea, stuff like that, and it had different applications. And so the Native American ethnobotany books really helped break down what tribes were using for what and kind of like the scientific names of all of these plants and where they come from. But kind of reading through and knowing the different applications that can be used for these plants is incredible. But really, for plant identification, I think that the books that you've selected are incredible for that. What really makes a difference, though, is just getting out and seeing them, like, in your hands, smelling them. Don't taste it right away until you really have narrowed down exactly what you have. But yeah, there's no better practice than just like going out and seeing it for yourself.
I agree. That's how I learned. And then maybe going with an expert can be very helpful as well.
Yeah.
As always, listeners should positively identify any wild plants or mushrooms before consuming them and consult qualified experts or health professionals regarding any medicinal uses. Well, anything else, Chef Candice, that you'd like to add about foraging or cooking or the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library?
Well, the library opens this 4th of July. We're sold out for the 4th, but have availability through the summer. And I'm excited to share in indigenous cooking and foraged and locally sourced foods. And hopefully not be too busy to not enjoy it myself.
Well, Chef Candice Stock, it's been a pleasure. It's always fun having you in the studio here in the radio studio, and we're very grateful to you for doing some TV with us and some events with children. That was really nice of you.
Yeah, no, it's been a pleasure, and it's been great speaking with you, Rick.
This has been another edition of Prairie Plates. I'm Rick Eon. We'll talk to you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. There may be no busier bird during the nesting season than a male house wren, because just a day or so after migrating back north from the tropics, he claims a territory and sets to work checking out potential nest cavities. Might be a birdhouse, a hollow pipe, an old nuthatch hole, or one of last year's oriole nests. And in each of these locations, the male house wren builds a starter nest. He'll stack a couple of dozen tiny twigs here, several hundred there, and he'll use whatever else comes to hand, or beak, too, from nails and bits of wire to paper clips and hairpins. Anything twig-like to get the job done. The male house wren stays at it until a female pairs with him. She now picks one of the starter nests and takes over construction, building a sturdy platform of sticks topped by a cup nest lined with grass, hair, feathers, even snake skin. The male's leftover starter nests may discourage other birds from nesting in those cavities. People maintaining bluebird houses have learned to dump out these dummy nests once a female house wren has made her choice. This helps bluebirds find a space to nest, at least until next spring, when that male house wren gets busy again. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 6th. May is National Historic Preservation Month. Today we are highlighting some of the historic places listed in North Dakota State Historic Sites Registry. In 1925, as part of a push to promote tourism in the United States, the Great Northern Railway organized the Upper Missouri Historical Expedition. The effort included plans to reconstruct Fort Union near Fort Buford in Williston. As part of this campaign, a series of memorial celebrations were held at Verendrye and Fort Union in North Dakota, and later at Meriwether in Montana. These events honored several early Pathfinders of the Northwest. Invitations were designed to resemble formal proclamations and were signed by the governors of North Dakota and Montana, along with members of both states' historical societies. David Thompson was among those honored on July 17th. An explorer and fur trader, he was the first European to navigate the full length of the Columbia River, one of his most notable achievements. On his first trading assignment, he worked to establish an alliance with the Mandan and Hidatsa at the mouth of the Knife River. During this time, he mapped the Northwest Company's posts and their relation to the American border. His surveys produced the first reliable map of the region, stretching from the west bend of the Souris River to the western shore of Lake Superior. Lewis and Clark later used this map during their expedition. Governor Sorley and other state officials attended the unveiling of a monument shaped like a sphere, provided by Ralph Budd, president of the Great Northern Railway. On July 1, 1967, the site was added to the State Historic Sites Registry. Today, the David Thompson State Historic Site honors his legacy. Located northeast of Velva, the site overlooks the Souris River Valley. A granite globe sits atop a rectangular base bearing an inscription to David Thompson, geographer and astronomer, who passed near this location in 1797 and 1798 during his expeditions. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The Alabama legislature has kicked off a special session on redistricting, this after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, removing race as a consideration for drawing district lines.
This is not just Alabama history. This is world history.
How lawmakers are debating redistricting on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's a wrap for this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tomorrow on the show, in a closer look with the Monitor, we'll explore two challenges shaping the future of North Dakota communities, education and housing. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.